This podcast is a member of the Place to Be Nation family. Visit us at placetobenation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world.
Well, hello everyone, and welcome to another edition of Letters from Kayfabe, and I'm here as ever with Alan. How are you doing, Alan?
I'm doing well, Parv. Another show to crack through some questions. Should we get right to it?
Yeah, let's do it. We will share details on how to get in touch with us at the end of the show.
Yeah, well, I'm forcing that now by going straight to the questions. But there we go.
We'll be back with the mailbag. Oh, and no doubt the mailbag has just arrived.
Well, if a postman delivered like that in England, I'd fire him immediately.
So the first one is, Dear Alan and Parv, my favourite wrestler is Mr. Hughes. In 1993, he seemed to be on a lot of TV, but never got a title shot or seemed to appear on pay-per-view events. What gives? And guess who that's from? It's from Chadley Crisolo in Norfolk, Connecticut. Chadley is now Mr. Hughes, so we've gone from Nikolai Volkoff in the last episode to Mr. Hughes in this one, and specifically 1993 piqued his interest with Mr. Hughes. So what was Mr. Hughes doing in WWF in 93, Parv?
I almost spat my Pepsi Max out then. As I often do, I went back and looked at his, you know, how he was built on TV and how he was brought in, and He comes in around just before WrestleMania, I want to say, just before WrestleMania 9. He didn't make the card, I don't believe. And, I mean, basically, he just kind of beats jobbers. He has a win over Owen Hart at one point. I don't really know, to be honest. It's kind of a random little run because he's gone virtually by the end, after the summer, isn't he?
Yeah, I mean, the run is literally 6 months. In that time, he was brought in, really, to feud with The Undertaker. And his most famous kind of thing was he stole The Undertaker's urn, and he was managed by Harvey Whippleman. So that was the whole six-month period, really. I mean, he was built up on TV at first to be a credible kind of challenger, or not challenger, someone who could, you know, compete with The Undertaker to a degree. And he did actually have a pay-per-view appearance as well, which we'll get to in a minute.
I remember it.
Yeah, so, I mean, he came in and he did have, I think he was on Raw 6-7 times during the run, so 7 times in 6 months isn't too bad. He was featured on the kind of syndicated shows as well, but he was kind of Mr. Hughes as a worker, Parv. Did you rate him much?
Well, I mean, he'd be coming off his WCW run here, wouldn't he? So it's not like he was a wrestler who was completely new to wrestling fans, although I guess many more eyeballs in WWF than WCW, I think that's fair to say.
Yeah.
No, not really. I mean, he was kind of better in that bodyguard role, I always thought. If anybody epitomised the bodyguard role, it was Mr. Hughes, wasn't it?
Yeah, and he was used later on 2 separate times, you know, later on in the 90s in, you know, kind of bodyguard role. The first one was with Triple H, wasn't it?
Well, one thing I will say is that when I was a kid, I did think that Mr. Hughes was cool because he was black and he wore sunglasses. So, and to my kind of 9 or 10 year old brain, that meant that you were cool in 1993.
He did kind of exude that kind of coolness with the sunglasses, which was always commented it was dangerous that he was wearing them as well.
He wore them in the ring. What a badass!
Yeah,
and I mean, I kind of like wearing the shirt, just going in the ring with a shirt and a pair of braces. And I guess, like, when Mr. Hughes did it, it looked cool. Less so when I arrested it.
So, yeah. The office worker versus the kind of mean bodyguard. Yeah, there's a difference there, isn't there? But yeah, I mean, he kind of went on a little house show run beating the likes of Virgil, obviously, and Tito Santana in, you know, April and May of 93. And he did beat Kamala by count out on Wrestling Challenge, which was the King of the Ring 93 qualifier.
Yeah, and I watched that match a few weeks ago, and that was one of the ones where Kamala basically had him beat, but he didn't know what to do with the pin, and essentially tries to pin him when he's on his stomach, and then, I don't know, rolls out the ring and ends up getting counted out. So that's what happened there.
So we missed out then, because Mr. Hughes went on to the King of the Ring, and he got beat by Mr. Perfect in the first round by DQ.
Yeah.
So we missed out on a Kamala-Mr. Perfect match there, unfortunately.
Do you think Kamala could have done much for Perfect in 93?
No, I mean, if he doesn't know how to pin people after a 10-year career, and he's, like I've touched in previous shows where he was like a Benjamin Button-type character where he was regressing, then no, I think he would have had much success against Mr. Perfect either. But yeah, Mr. Hughes, he stole The Undertaker's urn, he was cutting some promos on localised TV that I saw, you know, promoting house shows against The Undertaker. He was beating people like Bob Backlund as well in 93. I don't know, and Jim Duggan, looking at the results here.
And it's, I mean, for Jim Duggan to be doing jobs, you know, he must have been doing something right.
Well, the most interesting result that I turned up during this time was in 18th of July 93, where he beat Randy Savage on a house show.
Oh, yeah. And in fact, he was actually feuding with Savage a good bit, I saw. I mean, you can watch this play out. There are several face-to-face promos in July of 93. They do some at the London Gardens, they do some at Nassau, and then there's this European TV exclusive match with the German Coventry that was uploaded by our friend Richard Land. And yeah, I mean, it's German, but there's a 6-minute Randy Savage Mr. Hughes match that actually had a little bit of build through. It was actually like a mini angle going on there in the summer between the two of them.
Yeah, so we did have that little kind of thing where, like you said, it was on localised promos promoting some of the shows that they did as well. And he was with one of the guys that worked with the 123 Kid on Raw that squashed him before 123 Kid went on to that angle with Razor Ramon later on, which I found quite interesting. I mean, he did work Bret Hart as well, and then he went on to The Undertaker, which was the kind of final, you know, blow off to the whole kind of run that he had in 93. And I mean, the reason he left, I mean, Dave Meltzer said in the Observer, which is very specific, he just said Mr. Hughes will not be returning, and that was the end of it. I do know that in his 99 run, if he was with Jericho as his bodyguard, he had very specific reasons behind his departure, which apparently was him hanging around in unsavoury sex clubs, allegedly, and WWF didn't want to deal with the PR problems. But in 93, he seemed to be the big fat kind of monster heel that they loved in that period, because obviously they changed the look of the wrestlers, so he kind of suited what they wanted at that time period. But the reason that I read somewhere that he made advances, and this is why he left in 93, he made advances towards Sherry in the dressing room showers, and she kicked him in the balls.
Oh, right.
And he was fired soon after that. But I don't know how that time works time frame wise, because I don't know when Sherry hung around in 93 till, because Mr. Hughes was there up until, you know, the middle to the end of August. I know Sherry was feuding with Luna throughout 93 with Tatanka and Bigelow. I don't know if you remember that feud that they had.
Yeah, I was around WrestleMania 9 sort of time, yeah.
Yeah, so I think she may not have been around at that time period, so I don't know if that story is so true, but just the image of Sherry Martel kicking Mr. Hughes in the balls, you know, going off what he was into, he may have enjoyed it.
Interesting. Well, I mean, that surprises me a little bit, if only because you know, Sherry's later association with Harlem Heat.
yeah, no, that's true. I mean, and one last thing to touch on with Mr. Hughes. I mean, he was an all right, low, not all right. He was all right in flashes sometimes. In WCW, I saw kind of some flashes on TV. He was teaming with people like Vader, if you remember.
Yeah, I remember, yeah.
On TV. But, I mean, he's gone on to be, you know, a fantastic trainer in wrestling. He's got a promotion in Atlanta called WWWA4. they run shows on YouTube, and the actual shows are quite fun, actually. They run live shows for free. And he's some of the guys that he's trained that, you know, on the indie scene at the moment, and who are names like people like Heath Slater, who's in WWE at the moment, Jonathan Gresham, who's a great worker who's worked around the world, AR Fox, who's a nutcase, and Fred Yehi, who's, you know, great worker for Evolve. So he churned out some good workers. So it's not necessarily that you have to be a good worker to be a good trainer, and that's an example of that.
Well, I mean, talking about matches that look really strange on paper, Alan. I know that Mr. Hughes basically ends up going to ECW, doesn't he, after this WWE?
Yeah, he has that kind of early 94. I think he was on That the Line Was Crossed. He was featured on the TV, you know, opening credits as well, Mr. Hughes. So he was featured in ECW around this time, or just after.
Talk about matches that I literally cannot imagine what it would even look like. This is the 24th of September, 1994. Dory Funk Jr. defeats Mr. Hughes
in ECW in
Florida.
Yeah, well, that's Ocala, Florida. That's Dory Funk's stomping grounds around there. So that's probably the reason why I was working that show. Where I know he had his run, but against Mr. Hughes.
What would that match have even looked like? I just can't even imagine it, you know. So
in ECW as well, so I think they must have brawled. I mean, I couldn't imagine Dory Funk doing some butterfly suplexes. you know, shades of Nikolai Volkov there.
shall we move? So anyway, that's it's quite a long run in ECW, actually. He's there for quite a long time. And then, like you said, he crops back up in 99, doesn't he, Alan?
Yeah, 90. I think he does two runs. No, it's just a 99 one. I'm sure... he didn't know in 97. It's not listed on what we're looking at, but he didn't wrestle. He was Triple H's bodyguard. I know at Royal Rumble before China debuted in the February. Yeah, it was in Royal Rumble 97. He was Mr. Hughes was his bodyguard of Triple H.
Did he essentially replace Rick Rude in that role, I guess? I mean, Triple H had
No, Rick Rude was later. Rick Rude was Triple H's bodyguard at the tail end of 97. Right. Early 97, it was Hughes, and then China came in. They dropped Hughes quite quickly, and then China kind of was always around, but Rude was brought in as the muscle for DX.
I mean, the last thing I'll say about Mr. Hughes is that, I mean, people may disagree with me on this, but I guess I always felt that he should have been a bigger star. You'd think with that kind of look and that gimmick and just his general vibe, that he could have been a bigger star than he was, maybe?
Well, yeah, I mean, he did have some athletic background. I did think he played football. I think Jim Ross did comment on that in commentary from some of the footage we watched.
Yeah.
I mean, he was called the Big Cat.
Big Cat, yeah.
Yeah. So, and he was featured in WCW. He was on the Clash of the Champions, I think, against Brad Armstrong in 90. You know, and into 91, he was also featured on WCW kind of TV. So, some of it mustn't have clicked. I don't know what it was, but it might have been related to what we discussed, why he was fired later on. I know that he had narcolepsy.
Did he?
And that's touched on in Jericho's book, funnily enough, now it comes to mind. So that might not have helped his cause, but yeah, he used to fall asleep quite a lot when at random times backstage, so the wrestlers used to rib him a lot about that.
I can't see old Vince having any understanding or empathy for that sort of thing. So
no.
let's move on. What's the next question?
Well, the next question's quite an interesting one, Parv. It's, dear Alan and Parv, do you think that the WWF had an angle or further plans for Rita Marie, the first WWF female referee in 1985? So, Rita Marie, there's quite a lot to this story, really, isn't there, Parv? So, we haven't got too long to go into it, but what do we know about this?
Who is the letter from, Alan?
The letter is from J. Arsenio DiMatteo on Twitter, and J. Arsenio DiMatteo is from New York City, so thank you very much for the question.
Yeah, no, I think he's a place to be regular, that one. Okay, so I actually stumbled across Rita Marie watching a Terry Funk match randomly a couple of weeks ago, and I was like, whoa, is that a female ref? Where does she come from? And at first I thought it may be like Mike McGurk in an early role or something like that. And then it actually got started me hunting around for it. And then we got this question, as if by coincidence. Well, why didn't you tell us a bit about this, Alan?
Well, Rita Marie was Rita Chatterton, and she's more famous, not for this, for the accusations she made later on, because she accused Vince McMahon of rape on a TV show that I watched. I don't know if you did, Parv. It was called Now It Can Be Told, which was with Rivera, Geraldo Rivera.
Yes, and I've included this on the playlist for this week because it is a fascinating piece of, how should we put it, early 90s sensationalism.
Yeah, it was definitely around that time in the tabloid media in the US, and it all came out of the woodwork in the sex and steroid scandals around this time, in 91, 92, 94, that they had with the George Zahorian and then later on with Pat Patterson, the whole thing, and a lot of it's detailed in Sex, Lies and Headlocks. I don't know if you've ever read that book, Parv.
I've had a flick through it, but that's generally not the side of wrestling I'm not interested in, if you know what I mean.
Yeah, so, I mean, she was a female ref on TV, and this was, we were saying in 1985, because there was a match that I watched that she was refereeing in, and I can't remember, it was Jimmy Snuka, actually, in a squash match, and she wasn't even referenced at all as, anything bar just a normal referee, so it wasn't like Vince on commentary didn't make a big deal about her or anything like that, so that didn't come across to me anyway.
The only thing I'll say is that it's incredibly random, isn't it? That she crops up there as a female, because you never see women in just randomly in that role. Do you think Vince may have been trying to show that the WWF was an equal opportunity employer, or?
I don't know the kind of motivation behind it. I mean, that would be the most logical reason, to turn the female audience on that look.
Even in the real world, Alan, we saw it. It was only a few years ago where it was such a controversy in British football that there was a female linesman. Do you remember that?
Yeah, no. We've moved on since then.
Andy Gray ended up getting sacked over the whole thing.
There is institutional sexism in, British sports, especially sports like football, and, it took a lot of adjustment, and even things, touching on that, we'd have presenters now who present the sports stories and the news and even Match of the Day, and, there is some female presenters that do that, and it's more generally accepted now, but in 85, like you said, Parv, it wasn't, in wrestling especially, you didn't see this. I don't remember any female referees at all on WWF TV, unless it was in a gimmick role up until today.
What I couldn't find out is why did Rita Marie get into wrestling? How did she get into wrestling? Why was she there? Was she part of the State Athletic Commission? I couldn't really find out much stuff, because when you search for the name, when you look for stuff, it just comes up with the sex scandal stuff. That's all anybody ever says about her, so...
Yeah, she did allegedly try and extort Vincent Linda McMahon for $5 million for hush money to keep her quiet. So I don't know the validity of the story. It's not really for us to kind of comment on, rather than just say what, is out there already. And I think that's it really for Rita Marie. She was around for TV in the 80s, in 85, so I would say the middle of the year, because I think Snuka was gone by later in 85. So I think, there's not much more really to talk about. Obviously, the motivation was there to push her, like we said, as the first female referee, and kind of get a bit of buzz on it. She did touch on the Rivaldo piece that she was going to be featured in magazines. She's going to be famous for it. So there was this is what she said she was promised. And obviously, as a referee, you and I know, even as a female referee, there's only so much you can, make out of it. It's not going to be, we're going to make you a multimillionaire or anything like that.
Well, there's always Danny Davis. let's go to our last question then.
Okay, well, the last question we've got on this segment is, dear Alan and Parv, besides Ron Bass spurring Beefcake and Roberts de-pantsing Rude, where else has WWF used the big red X or black splotch to censor something on TV? And that's from Adam Czech on Twitter, from Czechoslovakia. So thank you very much, Adam Czech, for the question. So the big red X, the most famous one that I remember as a kid from the VHS SummerSlam 88 tape was the Ron Bass one. And I think, if I'm going to be honest, that's the reason it was given a 15 rating here in the UK.
What, SummerSlam 88?
Yes.
Oh, no. I don't want to sidetrack things, Adam, because this has been a conspiracy theory of mine for years. I thought it was because of we get a bit of Elizabeth skin at the end.
Well, I always thought that, but I tell a lie. I always heard people say that, but for me, it always stood out to me as a kid. It was the red X, because I'd never seen it done before. We're going to touch on on this question that it was done before, but to me, it really made it something that actually wasn't, because all in all, it wasn't as graphic as, you know, it was made out to be, that actual spearing of the forehead.
Interesting. Okay, well, do you have any other examples that you could think? I mean, there's one I'm sure that people are screaming at their radios already about the... There's another time where Jake Roberts is involved, isn't there? With Savage, of course. But I think that's the other one that would spring to mind immediately. But are there any others that are kind of under the radar that people might not remember?
Well, I think the first example we can have on TV, this was in the 80s. I think he may have done this in the... the other example, actually, to tell a lie, is Baron Von Raske in the late 70s in the old WWF used the brain claw.
Right.
And that was pushed as, you know, this horrific manoeuvre, so they censored it. I've not seen footage of that, so I don't know if it was the Red X that was used later on. But the first time that I saw on TV was Blackjack Mulligan.
Yeah.
Used it. I mean, that could have been to censor how bad Mulligan was. I don't know. It was against Joe Perkins on Championship Wrestling on May the 8th of 82.
We actually covered that match on Titans of Wrestling a while back. Yeah, and in fact, it actually led us to talk a little bit about the Big Red X, I seem to remember. They did do that. They censored the claw, but yet, chair shots, blood, all of that stuff was fair game. But for some reason, the claw was too terrible to be seen on TV, which is
I think it works, especially in that era, to use something like that to kind of push a certain move being devastating and really get people in the live gates to actually see what the maneuver is and how the person looks when they're being the maneuver's being applied. So
yeah.
I think it was a good tool to use in that era especially,
and they were actually building Mulligan as a threat to somebody who could actually beat Andre the Giant. So it needed, obviously, to beat Andre, who was never beaten, don't forget, you'd need something on that level that needs to be censored. That's how bad it is, So.
Yeah. It was used as well in 83, Don Morocco, on TV, on Championship Wrestling with Snuka. They did, kind of a wild brawl, and that was censored as well. I don't know if you've seen that one, Parv.
Yep. And, in fact, a lot of these are available on the WWE's website. I put the ones on the playlist that are on YouTube. These are the sorts of things that they will typically give copyright notices on, isn't it?
I've been guilty of putting some stuff out that's been taken down by them, so I do know that quite well.
That one is on the YouTube. It actually happened on a Rogers Corner, so tie into a previous show that we did.
Yeah, and there were some other examples as well. I mean, you touched on the Jake the Snake one with Savage, where the Cobra bit him, which was, the famous angle in 91.
Children crying,
Awesome angle. Really, really memorable angle, even to this day. That was me early on in my fandom, was just blown away by that, because to me, to rationalize it as a kid, I didn't, think that the snake had its fangs taken out or it was devenomized, even though it was kind of hinted on the commentary. I thought it was a wild angle for the time, so that really helped that. It wasn't always used, though, on all the footage of that angle. It was just maybe at certain times when it was aired, in the mornings.
Yeah, I seem to remember the actual bite happening on the tape that I had without the Red X.
The footage I remember as well, yeah. And there was one other time that I could remember myself was at the Royal Rumble in 2000, for comical reasons. Mae Young was in the Miss Royal Rumble swimsuit competition, got a bit carried away, and Jerry Lawler had to run and cover her up, and in the interim period it needed to be censored with the Big Red X. So I think, overall... There's use of it, there really is, and I think, I don't know how it would play, now, modern day, because, so much is caught by fans and filmed and put online, but, definitely in the 80s, I thought it could have been used more than it actually was.
Well, I mean, maybe it was kind of used sparingly so that when they did use it, it would actually have a lot of impact, I guess. Although the only one that anybody ever seems to be remember is the one that the listener asked about, is the Ron Bass one.
Yeah, the Ron Bass one, or the Roberts Rude one, where you saw, was it Rude's behind?
Oh, I think that's right. But you tended to see that quite a lot, Rude's behind, because all those warrior cage matches, there's usually a spot where his trunks come down. but they tend to, they don't use the red X in those scenarios, but just that little like floating distortion thing. Which of course they'd later use for Flair's belt as well.
Yeah, which was used well as well, and they had to use that because obviously they couldn't use the title after WCW kind of brought a court injunction, so they used the WWF tag team title, didn't they, Parv, as the prop?
Yeah, an old tag title, which is what one of the reasons for the distortion, of course.
Yeah.
Okay, well, let's go over now to our correspondent, JT Rosero, for this week's Event Center.
Let's take you down to the Event Center!
All right, thanks, Parvin Allen. JT Rosero here in the Letters from Kayfabe Event Center. Hope everyone's enjoying this week's episodes. But I'm here to take us back to 1994, right around this week. And that time, that's about 22 years ago, when a new program called Action Zone debuted. It was actually debuting on October 23rd, 1994. Of course, Vince McMahon and Todd Pettengill on commentary trying to get the show over, the boss himself. And it was a clip show. It was almost like a SportsCenter type show early on, but they would have feature matches. And the first main event of the debut show was Bret Hart and Owen Hart. Bret Hart retained his championship. It was billed as Owen's last chance. But the key match I wanted to cover actually took place a week later when Shawn Michaels and Diesel defended the tag team titles against Razor Ramon and the 1-2-3 Kid. Of course, a big battle of the Click, and the match was excellent. And this was really what started to fuel the rumors. The Click would only bust their ass against in matches involving themselves within the group. These guys went out there and killed it. In 22 minutes, Michaels pinned the Kid for the win. And, of course, they would see the continuation of the split between Shawn Michaels and Diesel here because he had super kicked him back at SummerSlam by accident, and he did it again here where he accidentally super kicked his partner during this match, and then he would do it again at Survivor Series, and that would officially sever ties between the two close friends. But again, Action Zone, kind of a forgotten show throughout history. I feel like this is one of the only matches you kind of remember from that run, but a lot of stuff happened. Vince would, of course, eventually fade off as he was the original announcer. Jim Ross would replace him. Gorilla Monsoon would fill in at times. By the end of 95, it became a strict highlight show, aired on Sunday mornings, filled in with highlights from Raw and Superstars, hosted by Todd Pettengill and Doc Hendricks, canceled and replaced by Superstars, which would move from syndication, as we talked about a few weeks ago. So that's a match you can easily track down. There's some other hidden gems throughout the history of Action Zone. I definitely recommend trying to dig those up because there's a lot of cool little hidden gems on some of these shows that occurred on either USA programming or syndication programming. And of course, the Click, a hot topic back in 1994 and 95. And this was really the very early moments in their run of power throughout the backstage of the World Wrestling Federation. So be sure to follow us on all of our social media avenues and follow all of our iTunes feeds, The Place to Be Podcast, PWO, PTBN, PTBN Pop, and The Kevin Kelly Show. And you can find us each and every week here, Letters from Kayfabe. We're going to send it back over to Parv and a chap called Alan. I'm JT. We're out. We'll talk to you in a week.
All right. Well, thank you for that, Mr. Rosero. Any comments for the CEO of PTBN this week?
Well, JT, I finally got something. It was pretty disappointing, I'm not going to lie. It managed to get me a packet of crisps and a can of soda. So, JT, if that's what you think I'm worth, then I don't know what to say. But, you know, me and you going to have a conversation. And maybe next time you can work out something a little bit better for me. And that's all I've got to say to the CEO at the moment.
He's been sending me private messages, Alan, saying things like, Alan is the Nikolai Volkov of the PTBN Corporation and things like that.
Well, that comes across well, you know, in terms of what I've been given for doing the shows. So hopefully I can promote it up the kind of ranks into more of a mid-range King Kong Bundy position.
Do we have maybe a bigger topic from a listener this week?
Yeah, we've got quite a good one and a long one we can sink our teeth into here, Parv. Dear Alan and Parv, I'd like to hear you guys go into detail about those type of guys. The guys who weren't true jobbers, but they were never going to get an action figure and rarely, if ever, worked the syndicated shows. I'm talking about the Jim Powers, Scott Caseys, Al Perez's, Tim Horners and Chris Walkers of the world. They moved away from this period of when Raw launched, but there used to be a grey area between a jobber and a superstar. And that's from the Chief, who sent that in at Pro Wrestling Only. So thank you very much for that question. So getting in, there's a few of the names he's mentioned there that I'd like to touch on upon, Parv, but have you got anything to start this one off?
Yeah, well, I mean, I do think that there's a kind of jobber tradition in the WWF where there always was a hierarchy. And, you know, I've watched a lot of the older stuff with the Titans of Wrestling. So there's a clear difference, for example, between Frankie Williams right down the bottom. I mean, Frankie Williams basically could barely throw a punch in a match, you know. He just get, like, you know, he'd tag in and immediately start getting his ass handed to him. So there was him, pure jobber. Then there was your kind of older star who'd started to slide down the card. Dominic DiNucci, Baron Cicluna, famously. Those guys were still kind of almost like the gatekeepers to the main roster, if that makes any sense.
Where would you rate someone like Sal Bellomo in that, though?
So, this is interesting. So, Sal Bellomo, for example, comes in, and he does have a little bit of a push in 82, 83. By the time you get to 84, he's mostly having losing efforts, including against people like Bobby the Brain Heenan. So Sal Bellomo, maybe at the, I don't know, because he did have TV time. He did appear on TNT. Iron Mike Sharp would be another sort of guy in this category who, you know, when he was first brought in, maybe even had a title shot or two.
Yeah, I remember that because he unfortunately recently passed away, and I think that was mentioned that he did have a kind of little run on top where he made, you know, a few shots against the champion.
So I would definitely say that, like, your Iron Mike Sharp or your Sal Bellomo was a step up from, for example, the Duke of Dorchester, Pete Doherty.
Yeah, no, I'd agree.
And these sorts of guys that you're talking about here, I would say, I mean, we talked about one a few weeks ago, Buddy Rose, okay? I would put Buddy Rose on the same level as those guys, Sal Bellomo, as, who was the other one that you mentioned just now? Iron Mike Sharp.
Yeah.
ST Jones basically was probably the king of all of those guys, because he don't forget, did get an action figure, famously.
And he was on WrestleMania as well, to be fair.
ST Jones made WrestleMania. He would be right at the top there. Another guy I'd put in around the ST Jones level would be someone like George Wells from that era.
Yeah, that was 86. He was against Jake Roberts at WrestleMania as well, wasn't he?
So those guys would be like the absolute kings, like the JT, like they would be what we call a jobber to the stars. And there's quite a big gulf between those guys and the true jobbers. And these guys that you're talking about here would have, I mean, there would have been equivalents to them in and around 86, 87, 88. You know, guys who appear on TV, maybe they'll pick up a win once in a blue moon, but they're mostly there. So, I mean, Rene Goulet is one that I would point to. Rene Goulet is clearly below SD Jones in that hierarchy, for example.
Yeah, and I mean, the term jobber to the stars is really a hardcore term, and it's not an insider term as such. It was coined more online in the 90s. And I think the important thing is the people that were in this kind of category, there was some use for them, really, wasn't there, Parv? I mean, for me, it really only worked on TV if the announcers were doing their job. So if they put over your Jim Powers or your Al Perez or your Tim Horners, it gave the guys who beat them the rub, didn't it? I mean, if they weren't mentioned at all, there could have been any other jobber. But because they had a little bit of history, or they looked more in shape, so they could be pushed a little bit more as a threat.
Yeah, I mean, and the history of the WWF is kind of strewn with these guys. Another one I'd think about would be someone like, I mean, we've talked about many of them on this show, like the Billy Jack Haynes post the Funk's run, for example, kind of settled down into a slot like this, or Corporal Kirshner after, like, Slaughter'd gone and, you know, there was nothing left for him to do. Trying to think of some other ones. Chris Walker.
Do you remember the Predator?
The Predator, yes.
Who was Horace Hogan, I believe.
I mean, the thing is that they had more, like, there's a little bit of nuance in here that kind of just gets forgotten along the way, I guess, which is that frequently at the house shows, the opener, and this is the sort of thing that we watch on a little side project that we have called Mystery Titans Theatre, Alan. I don't know if you've ever seen it, where we basically watch full house show cards from, you know, from the WWF around this time. And, I mean, a frequent trope of that is that you might get a 15-minute match between two of these guys who are at the same level. So, you know, you might get, you know, a Jim Powers versus a Scott Casey, say, and that match, because they're at the same level, goes on for 10, 15 minutes. They get to show a bit more of what they can do. And the idea is that the competition is stiff, you know?
There's examples of this, you know. You're mentioning what, this round 84 period.
Well, I guess I'm talking about even up into they do it the whole time, you know. A guy like, I don't know, Steve Gator Wolf, like where they'd have matches that go on much longer than you'd expect when you get two guys who are at the same level. And as far as I'm aware, they keep on doing this, even into the early 90s.
Well, I've got a great example. 94. This is the dark match for the Royal Rumble in 94. The Brooklyn Brawler defeats Jim Powers.
Well, there we go. I mean, how long did that one go?
It doesn't list actually the length of the match, but I imagine as a dark match, it would have gone at least, you know, 10 minutes, I would say, just to get the crowd, you know, going.
Yeah, I mean, they do. And I mean, what's interesting is that they're kind of building the idea of, like, stiff divisions of competition, if that makes any sense, where you have, you know, like, things are so tough in the WWF that for a guy like this to get a win over a guy like this is actually really hard. So that when, I don't know, Mr. Hughes comes in against one of those guys and he beats him in 4 minutes, is actually really, you know, you realize how tough Mr. Hughes is, you know? And that's, you know, the kind of layers of hierarchy in that low down level of the card is something that I think gives the illusion of depth and gives the illusion of wrestling as a real sport. You know, it's actually something that I think is good. And I'm one of those people, Alan, who actually laments the loss of the, not just the jobber, but the JTTS and all of this sort of business in wrestling, where it feels like, when I've watched wrestling in more recent years, it feels like everybody's kind of at the same level, you know?
No, I think that, so it's the 50-50 world now where everyone just trades wins and losses. But yeah, definitely at the time there was a hierarchy and there was people, you know, bottom of the card, middle of the card, top of the card. So like the names you mentioned, and I think what's an interesting point is a lot of people, you know, had territorial runs before this. So, you know, Scott Casey, Al Perez, Tim Horner, you know, are all examples of that. DJ Peterson, Brad Reagans. I mean, a lot of them, because the territories were dying, they were still getting paid better doing a role like this for the WWF than they were, you know, working for the AWA or for whoever in the late 80s.
I mean, I watched this car with Kelly the other night. This was MSG, April the 22nd, 1986. And if you want to watch that card, it's on YouTube. If you want to watch that card with me and Kelly mumbling all over it, you know, where we give our own commentary, essentially, that's also on YouTube on the Mystery Titans Theatre. Let me just run down this card and you'll get an impression of what I'm talking about, okay? The opener for that card in a match that goes a good 15 minutes, Alan, okay? And I should say the idea of Mystery Titans Theatre is that we watch not the best cards available. So it's a bit like the old Mystery,
Theatre.
It's a bit like that old show where they're forced to watch bad films. So the opening match was Lanny Poffo versus René Goulet. Now, can you even think about who would go over in that match?
No, I would probably say René Goulet went over in that match.
Well, it was actually Lanny Poffo.
There I am. René Goulet was actually the first man that scored a pinfall victory over Ric Flair on TV.
but so there you have it. I mean, Lanny Poffo was a guy who had history in, you know, ICW. He had some name recognition. René Goulet had been around the block a long time. And, you know, that match puts over the idea that Rene Goulet is still a tough guy who needs to be overcome. And Lanny Poffo is somebody who's, you know, got some skill. So that then, when somebody higher up the card beats Lanny Poffo in a couple of weeks, it actually means something. Then there was Nikolai Volkov versus Tony Garea. Now, you can realize who goes over there. And you can see that Tony Garea is, you know, at that point in his career, five-time former tag team champion.
And a man with a great hair. A
man with still a great hairline. But he's, you know, he slipped down the card at this time, and that's what, you know, he's still fulfilling a role. And it still means something to beat Tony Garea, you know. Then there was King Tonga versus Paul Christie. Now, Paul Christie was a guy who fans from the WWA would have recognized. You know, he had some notoriety, you know, limited, I guess, but...
Was he in Dick the Bruiser's WWA?
Yeah, Dick the Bruiser's WWA. In fact, Paul Christie had, like, a really cool Elvis haircut. but, I mean, there he was. He, you know, he was a decent hand, I guess, somebody to put somebody over. Sifi Afi versus Iron Mike Sharp, a match that goes way longer than you'd want it to. And, I mean, Sifi Afi can only get a count-out win against Iron Mike there. So it's just getting kind of build it, and then you get Dynamite Kid versus Brutus Beefcake. You know, two big stars. Like, Dynamite Kid would kill any of those guys, you know. But,
well, when would you say on the card the interval would be? Would it be after those first matches you mentioned?
Well, I think the interval comes Randy Savage versus Tito Santana, no DQ.
Okay.
And then they have a bit of a break.
Yeah.
They come back with Davey Boy versus Greg Valentine, Corporal Kirshner versus Iron Sheik, and then Pedro Morales, who by this point was putting over quite a lot of people on TV, but he's taken on Tiger Chung Lee, somebody closer to his level, more competitive match, and of course Pedro will win that one. And it still means something to beat Pedro Morales. It still means something to beat Tiger Chung Lee. Jake Roberts against Scott McGee. He's another one, actually, who's kind of on this level, would you say?
Yeah, no, Scott McGee definitely. He was around for quite some time, kind of putting people over.
So, I mean, and you can basically do that with any of the house show cards. Because your pure jobbers would basically do TV, and then for the house shows, they wouldn't really entrust the pure jobbers with a proper featured house show match. So that's where your Rene Goulets come in a bit more, you know.
Oh, yeah, I mean, the trusted workers, and, you know, they can work a convincing 10-plus minute match. So it's important that you have guys who are full-time, who are, you know, the stars, can trust. And, you know, it's important that, you know, they're not going to be getting injured. So you're not going to be working against some guy that's, you know, enhancement talent, that's, you know, a wrestler trainer that's been brought in for TV, because, you know, they're just there to take, you know, the moves and the pinfall. This is more competitive. It's got to tell a story.
Now, before we finish up on this topic, Alan, I have to ask you, who are some of your favourites of this kind of guy over the years?
Well, the one that was around for the longest, I would say, was Jim Powers. I don't know if you would agree. I mean, he came in 1985, and he was still lingering around, you know, nearly 10 years later. So he had a fair run, you know, throughout many, you know, a few different eras there in the WWF. He was brought in part of the kind of jobber tag team with Paul Roma, if you remember, the Young Stallions.
Yeah, no, is that his biggest push, would you say, the Young Stallions deal?
Yeah, definitely, because he was on pay-per-view. They were on a Survivor Series team. I think it was a 10-man one in 88, if memory serves me correctly. And they did beat some people on TV. They beat Barry Horowitz in the Brooklyn Brawler, and they got a DQ win over the Hart Foundation. but there's a kind of story with the Hart Foundation that the WWF even gave them some theme music. So they were pushed because they had theme music to a degree. And the storyline was that Jimmy Hart wrote it for the Hart Foundation, but the Young Stallions took it for themselves. So I don't know how that works, to be totally honest. But as we touched on the previous episode, Jimmy Hart did write a lot of theme music. So maybe it was lying around someday in catering, and the Young Stallions took it and recorded it themselves. You don't know.
Wow.
But yeah, Jim Powers, he was a short kind of guy, stocky. He had a great body for the era, but he was only like 5'9" or 5'10". He wasn't tall at all, and he moved quite awkwardly in the ring. He was slow. He did a few kind of drop kick type maneuvers, but to me, he was someone that was not a very good seller as well. And when you're in that level or that role, I think that's a bad thing. But obviously, maybe I'm not seeing what other people saw because he was around for years.
Well, I mean, that's another kind of, I mean, especially for the Vince one, you know, the ones that Vince has brought through himself quite a bit. You see this. I mean, Rick McGraw would be an early example of a kind of guy who is stacked, who is clearly maybe on the juice a little bit, but he's short. You know, he's no taller than 5'10", 5'11", kind of short, stocky, and Vince seemed to put a lot of those sorts of guys in these roles where they kind of looked good enough to be on TV, but not, they weren't big enough to be given a major push. And I'm trying to think of some other example. Can you think of any?
Well, there was classic Vince projects. I mean, if we're touching on things like, you know, the Tom McGee. I mean, that's the most famous one or infamous one. I mean, there's footage of him. He's athletic as hell. He's got, you know, a complete bodybuilder's. He's a freak athlete, but he just couldn't, you know, put it together in the ring, really. But he was doing moonsaults and all sorts of backflips. You know, for a man that size in the, you know, late 80s, he was wow. But as a worker in the ring, he was nothing.
I mean, Scott McGee is kind of another guy like that where he's kind of like big, you know, big, clearly works out in the gym, got a decent body, but just not big enough.
Well, I think these might be guys that Vince, you know, he loves, you know, the body guys. So, and another great example is Chris Walker, who was used in the early 90s and disappeared at a time when you'd expect someone with his body type to disappear. But I think he's a really interesting one because looking through his career, he was billed as Conan Chris Walker, and he was in like some indies like Georgia All-Star in 1991 and the Global Wrestling Federation, you know, that had TV. But he actually, his first match was in January 1990 in the WWF, where he teamed with a guy called Butch Stanley against the Powers of Pain. So I think he's a guy that Vince just found in a gym. Seriously, I just think he found him one day in a gym and, you know, put him in a match, realised he was no good and just sent him out and said, come back in a few years. Because he did come back in 92 and have a couple of dark matches on pay-per-view. His most notable one was at the Royal Rumble in 92, and he beat the Brooklyn Brawler, and Jack Tunney actually came out to the live crowd, I don't know if you know this, Parv, and reversed the decision because the Brooklyn Brawler pinned him initially with his feet on the ropes.
And Jack Tunney, when was this? What year was that?
Royal Rumble 92. Chris Walker was in the dark match against the Brooklyn
Jack
Brawler.
Jack Tunney
made
the appearance, and well, I didn't know that.
Yeah, I know, I thought you'd like that one.
Wow. I mean, Jack Tunney started to interfere more and more in 92, 93, making those on-the-fly decisions. Somebody should have told him you can't just change the rules of wrestling in the middle, you know. He did that a lot around that time, Tunney. So he had a dark show appearance. Okay.
Well, yeah, we with him as well, just to touch on, he did have a squash match with Sid that made TV, where Sid just kind of killed him, which was building Sid up for the match against Hogan. And what happened to him now is just looking into him, because he's not really well known, and I found out that he runs a bar in Tampa, apparently. So that's a place where a lot of wrestlers live. And, you know, looking at him, he looks like a cross between really Kerry Von Erich, and the Ultimate Warrior, really, I would say. He had the kind of leotard, the bright leotard with the face. I think he had a bit of face paint now and again in his run. And I think what let him down was he just wasn't very good. And, you know, at the time, he just wasn't tall enough. But the interesting thing what I found out as well about him, Parv, was he appeared in the UK in the summer holidays in 1994 as a rip-off Ultimate Warrior character versus, guess who, the Iron Sheik.
In 1994?
In the UK.
Wow, okay. Well, was that like an indie show?
Yeah, that was... it was one of those kind of tribute shows. He was playing a rip-off Ultimate Warrior character. So, and there's also... There was him tagging with Big Bully Buskick.
Yeah.
You know, if you remember him. And they were against Demolition 2000, which was Demolition Axe and Demolition Blast. One of the guys that Bill Eady used to use when, you know, Smash was still working for WCW.
Dear me. Who was that then? Who was Blaster?
I don't know who he was, but he's been touched upon on 605 podcast, some of the incarnations of Demolition, but I've no idea myself who Blast was, but obviously a friend of Belides that he trusted with the character and went on the road with him to do some indie shots.
Wow.
So that's Chris Walker. So there's a few interesting comments about him, but there's other guys as well, like we touched on, that had names before they came in. There was Scott Casey, who'd been around in Southwest for a few years, and he had a decent running World Class as well. And there was Al Perez, if you remember him as well, Parv.
Sam Houston, I throw in there. He had a bit of a run with the WWF at one time, did he not, in 87?
Yeah. And I think there's a theme with a few of these guys that they were used in Survivor Series teams in like the opening Survivor Series match. I know that Scott Casey was used in the 88 one, and he was substituting actually in the 88 one for Brian Blair, who was actually injured, who funnily enough was actually not supposed to be on that match as well. It was supposed to be JYD. But JYD was fired in October 88 on the European tour as well as Don Morocco. So Scott Casey was in that match because Brian Blair was injured, who was supposed to be in the match because JYD was fired. So that's quite interesting how he ended up on the card there.
Well, I've been looking through old MSG results to find like the least star-studded featured match that I could find. And from January the 25th, 1988, how about this one? Omar Atlas pinned Dusty Wolf. Can anybody beat that one?
No, that's and then that was in 88 as well, Omar Atlas.
Omar Atlas pinned Dusty Wolf in 7:29. So
I only got the win as well.
You did, yeah. Oh, Iron Mike Sharp pinned Jerry Allen. That was at May the 27th, 88. So, you know, these matches still took place.
But yeah, I mean, the one I wanted to talk about was Al Perez as well, who had a run in late October 89 until July of 1990. He was a guy who was never really given a gimmick. He was just called Al Perez. He was a guy that was more famously known from World Class. I don't know if you remember him at all, part before this run.
I mean, yeah, he's actually one of Chad Campbell's favourite wrestlers, so I just thought I'd mention that.
Oh, right. He was a good hand, and WWF told him that he couldn't throw a forearm because Tito Santana used it as a finisher, and he couldn't use a swinging neck breaker because Honky Tonk Man used it as a finisher, and so on and so on. And he also said that they wanted him to be more colourful and that he should get a ring jacket, to which he apparently replied, "Well, I'm not cold, so why do I need a ring jacket?" So he had a bit of a weird attitude there, but he went on to tell a story about Pat Patterson, which was quite a bit of a rib on Al, where Pat Patterson said, "Al, we're going to give you something so much to do, you're going to do great. Beside, I hear that you go both ways." So apparently Al, who had heard Patterson, obviously the rumours about Pat Patterson, kicked the table over that he was sitting at when he apparently said this to him and said, "Hell no." And Patterson replied, no, "I meant to say good guy, bad guy. You know, to go both ways." So that was a bit of a rib there on Al Perez. And he went on to say that Vince basically said that it wasn't working out at the end and just thanked him for the opportunity, you know, for it. And that was the end of him. So he was used a bit for about a 6-month period.
I can see he got a win at MSG here in January the 15th of 90. Al Perez pinned Paul Roma at 11:18 when the momentum of a flying crossbody by Roma put Perez on top. So there we go.
Well, the most interesting match that I found that he was in, and Tim Horner and Dusty Wolf, which was a dark match for the WWF live show that was on Sky One, you know, from the London Arena in 89. Do you remember this show, Parv?
Did this make the video?
No, this didn't at all. It was a dark match. No, you won't remember this match. It was interesting because the opponents on this match were Dave Finlay, Mark Rocco, and Skull Murphy.
Okay.
Which is quite interesting. Obviously, they were used as guys that WWF brought in because they were known on the British scene around this time, and they were famous on TV before it got took off. World of Sport got took off TV. So that's an interesting one. I don't know if you'd ever realised that match occurred.
No, it was a very bizarre match to be on a WWF card.
Yeah, so I would have loved to have seen handheld footage of that match, but I don't think any's ever shown up. But that's an interesting one. So is there anyone else that you want to talk about? It's kind of these jobber to the stars guys that got wins. Like Al Perez, as we said, he got wins against Horwitz. He got wins. He drew with Paul Roma. You know, when you know there was rare draws on house shows, he got a draw. So that probably went 15 minutes, that match.
No, I mean, I think we've mentioned all the ones that I would want to think of. J.W. Storm, a name that you remember from it?
Yeah, I mean, J.W. Storm, he was another one that was in, like, 92 era, if I remember correctly.
Yeah, around that sort of time. Because, I mean, obviously, even at that level of the card, there's a bit of a turnover, isn't there? So, like, the older guard gets faded out, and then there's kind of like a new JTTS crew come in. And J.W. Storm's certainly in that mix. One of the things I wonder about is how do you quantify all of this? You know, where do you put those guys versus the guys who slipped down the car, which is many of the people that we've talked about, you know, your Colonel Mustafa's, your Ronnie Garvin in 90, you know, many of the people we featured on previous shows. You see these guys as a cut below those fading stars, would you?
Oh yeah, definitely, because they're not given any promo time, you know, at all. The more used on dark matches, house show, they are used on TV now and again. I do remember Al Perez being on Challenge, for instance, in 89 or 90. But there were more for house shows. I got more of a kick out of the guys we mentioned, your Colonel Mustafas and hanging around in 92 and your Virgils and people of that ilk and these kind of guys, but they all still tell an interesting story, and I think there was definitely a place for them on the card, you know, in this era of the WWF. I think to kind of tie the question in at the end, you know, why this phased out was by 93 you had Raw and the WWF TV started looking, you know, a little bit different. And if you remember around this time, they were also scaling back the house show business.
Yeah.
So they went from like three crews to two crews and eventually to one crew. So there's no use for this kind of guy because they were using the full talent.
Didn't they stop showing house shows on TV as well? Like the MSG TV show and all of that sort of stuff. Didn't they actually stop showing them?
Yeah, that would have been 92, I think. I do remember MSG shows that you would be aired in early 92, but... correct me if I'm wrong, any listeners, but I don't think there was many after that.
I think they all kind of go dark after that, so that would be another, you know, another reason. Although, I mean, I do want to say maybe like Sparky Plug, Barry. Remember when Barry Horowitz had a bit of a kind of tiny bit of a push there in?
Oh, in '95, where he beat Skip and he went on and tagged with, I think, 123 Kid or Hakushi. They had some sort of little group.
I mean, where would you put Sparky Plug on the old hierarchy? Like in that era,
He was around. Sparky Plug, we went on to be Bob Holly, was 94. He was WrestleMania 10. He was going to be featured on that. But a lot of these guys, though, I don't know. They were ex-territory guys, not all of them, or they were projects. So maybe, but the project guys like your Tom McGee's and your Chris Walker's didn't really go on to pay-per-view, so I think Sparky Plug is in the middle ground of the two, if that makes sense.
Yeah, maybe even just basically what we'd call a lower mid-carder, as opposed to a proper JTTS, you know.
Yeah, definitely. I think there's a separation between the two.
Well, I hope we covered that in the sufficient depth for the listener there. For the chief, I'm sure there's plenty of guys we haven't mentioned. But if you did have any favorites, why don't you let us know about them?
The new World Wrestling Federation magazine is now on sale. All this and more in the official World Wrestling Federation magazine, on sale this Tuesday at your local newsstand.
All right, well, just before we wrap up, Alan, shall we take our weekly look into the corner of the WWF magazine?
Yeah, let's go for it. I've found an article here from WWF Magazine, January 1992, and this is on page 23, and it's basically discussing what Jim Neidhart is kind of doing with his career at the end of 91. So, if you remember, Parv, he really wasn't doing much after the split from Brett, was he?
No man's land.
Yeah, he wasn't doing much. So he had a match on TV versus Flair. So the article kind of discusses his this match with Flair and saying, the thing that interests me, it says that Jim the Anvil Neidhart decided to concentrate on singles competition last summer. So they're kind of trying to play it that it was his decision that he was in a singles competitor at this point, which is not really what the case was it, Parv? Because Brett was the IC champion by this point.
That's right, yeah. And Brett had been angling for a singles run for a long time, I think.
Yeah, there was a kind of failed attempt a few years before where they split the two of them off, and then, you know, it didn't really work at the time, so they brought them back together. But yeah, it discusses that he had this match with Ric Flair, and Ric Flair and him, they went back and forth till Ric Flair was treacherous and cheated and things like that, and targeted his knee, and then he wouldn't let go of the figure four leg lock until people had to come up and split it. So after that happened, that Flair beat at Neidhart, he was going to the back clutching his knee. And as he was going back, the Beverly Brothers, who were managed by Genius at the time, were coming out to have their match next. And they basically laughed at the plight of the anvil. is how it's worded. And then for no other reason than pure malice, the Beverlys besieged Neidhart. It was a brutal attack. Bo and Blake mercilessly pounded and kicked Neidhart's leg. They ran him headfirst into the surrounding barricades, then hacked away at Neidhart's limb until his leg looked like it was hanging from a thread. So they basically, that excused the reason why Neidhart wasn't able to be at the Survivor Series.
Right.
So he was obviously involved in a team at Survivor Series. But if you remember around this time, he was doing a lot of commentary, wasn't he, Parv?
I don't remember Neidhart on commentary. What shows was he on? Like,
oh, well, the one that stood out, I don't know, you'll remember this, is when the NWA title was introduced by Heenan.
Oh, yeah, around that time, okay.
And he was stood there with Heenan looking shocked, him in Monsoon. He was doing the commentary there, I think it was on Challenge, around that time. He was just on camera just stroking his beard over and over. I mean, you've got to, you know, stroke it that much to get that fine point on the end of it.
That's that kind of weird period, isn't it, where, like, all sorts of random people, like Honky has a little run on commentary, doesn't he, in, like, late 90, I want to say. And then I think Neidhart maybe takes over from Honky.
Yeah, it's basically to set up this kind of angle here is with the Beverly Brothers, was to set up the new foundation with Owen at heart. So it was trying to move him into that tag kind of match with Owen versus the Beverly. So it explains something that really wasn't really explained as well on TV. And that's kind of the point of the WWF magazine, isn't it?
Well, I mean, I find it very surprising the way they've worded this, where he's focusing on singles competition. He thought he'd never wrestle in tag team action again. However, outside forces have changed all that. So the Neidhart, by circumstances, thrust back into tag action.
Yeah, there we go. So it's, he had no choice in the matter. But yeah, he didn't really do much. He had the team. Did he have the team with Owen? And then Owen went with Coco in High Energy.
Yeah, I want to say High Energy were together as early as 92.
Yeah, I think it was after this, though, wasn't it?
Yeah. So this would obviously be late 91 if Flair was around.
Yeah.
This must have been, like, the first thing the Beverly Brothers did, I'd imagine.
Well, we discussed, I think it was on earlier, the Beverly Brothers' debut. It was on a previous episode. It was when the coach kind of left. So it was around this time. It was around October time, so it kind of would fit. The Beverly Brothers weren't up to much, so they had to kind of get into a feud with someone, didn't they? So yeah, that's it with Neidhart. Hopefully we'll cover him again. He may crop up in the future, Parv.
Yeah, I'm sure we'll be seeing the Anvil again.
All right, well, if people want to get in touch, Alan, how do they do that?
Well, the best way to get in touch with us is on Twitter. And for me, Parv, it's at Alan_Cheapshot. So that's ALLAN_Cheapshot. And yourself, I believe you're at Jerry Von K. I think I've got that one right, haven't I, Parv?
Yes, and if you do want to ask us a question, maybe use that, what was it, the hashtag LettersFromKayfabe, which will help us locate it. Because, you know, especially with the rate that this guy tweets, they get lost pretty quickly, don't they?
Oh God, where with me? I'm churning out the tweets. I feel like a machine some days, the amount of stuff and content I pump out. But yeah, if you want to get us on Twitter, that's how you reach us. But you can also get us on Pro Wrestling Only forums for a discussion. We on each show, Parv, don't we? We put there's a thread there where people chime in. We can have a discussion and, you know, flesh things out a little bit more if people are interested.
Yeah, and well, and of course you can go longer than 140 characters in there, which is why, you know, a lot of the time the longer topic has come from Pro Wrestling Only, because people can write more, I guess. There's also Facebook as well, on the PWO PTBN page, and on the Place to Be and live group that some people are a part of. Those are all of the main ways that you can get in touch. So, well, it's been fun, Alan. Thank you for listening, everybody.
Adios.
All right, joining me right now, Mr. Hughes, along with his manager, Harvey Whippleman. Of course, Hughes is going to be teaming up with the 8-foot-tall giant Gonzalez. Their opponents, The Undertaker and the legendary Macho Man Randy Savage, speaking for The Undertaker in his absence. Now, Mach, let's explain this. Mr. Hughes has the urn that belongs to The Undertaker.
Absolutely. I'm on a roll right here, so don't stop me. Me and Gene Oakland, Nassau Coliseum will never be the same again, because I bring him up and the Taker brings him down. Yeah, we are a tag team combination that's going to get something done. Yeah, TCB, take care of business. And on Friday the 13th, I'm going to take Lawler all the way out. Yeah, of the WWF. Whippleman, got a slap for you, dang it. Hey.
Harvey, where...
What do you want, Oakland, you white trash?
Where is the big 8-foot-tall giant Gonzalez this week?
Well, when we told him that we were going to be discussing a tag team match against the Macho Man and the Undertaker in Nassau Coliseum, the giant said he didn't want to have any part of talking to all those trashy, nasty, buck-tooth varmints in the New York area. Hey, but just what?
Well, what about that urn? You know, you are really flaunting it, Mr. Hughes. I think you're out of line. That belongs to the Undertaker and Paul Bearer.
Minji, let me tell you something. This don't belong to nobody. Nobody but me. You see, I'm the man who took all this. You see that dip right there on that there, Mean Gene? I'm the one that put it on that head of the Undertaker. Undertaker, can you still feel that bump? Huh? Has it went down yet? Where's Paul Bearer at? I'm going to tell you something, Undertaker.
The Macho Man is getting the hot news.
Brother, let me tell you the way it is.
Going down with the sidewalk tram? I promise you that. Have a nice day.
You going down? Well, I've been to your neighborhood and I've been to mine, and we're going to take you out of Nassau Coliseum. Dig it, yeah.